This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Felipe de Jesus Molina Mendoza came to the U.S. at the age of 8. His family hired smugglers to help them run across the U.S.-Mexican border. And now, years later, Felipe's family is here in North Carolina. He has been asking for asylum in the U.S. He's openly gay. And the last time he was in Mexico, he says he was harassed and repeatedly and violently attacked because of his sexual orientation. He says despite laws allowing same-sex marriage in Mexico, it is not a safe country for people who are openly gay. While his asylum case is going through an appeal, Felipe also faces possible deportation. Tomorrow, he finds out if he can stay in the U.S. He's been told to appear at an Immigration and Customs Enforcement office in Charlotte with his bags packed and a plane ticket in hand. Felipe de Jesus Molina Mendoza joins us now. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much for the opportunity of having me here, and it's a pleasure.
Well, it's good to have you here and to hear your story. I know that you have become the face of undocumented immigrants and asylum seekers in the U.S. at the moment. You're speaking at rallies and talking about, you know, you've gone public, but your decision to go public was not an easy one. Tell us about deciding to talk openly about your situation.
Yeah, it has definitely not been easy. For the longest time, I thought, people don't really wouldn't care about my case. And to a point, I kind of, you definitely hear about the news, the media, what's going on. So you see a lot of anti-immigrant, propaganda going on. So it's kind of hard to decide, if to make your story public because, you never know exactly what you're going to get in return. But I'm actually glad I did take that choice to make it go public because I can actually show people the reality, the human side of immigrants, and kind of start humanizing people again. And I think that's something that the media has, not all the media, but some of the media has taken upon themselves to make us, instead of humans, just a number.
You found out about your deportation on Christmas Eve. Tell us about that when you found out.
Yeah, so I was getting off for work and, I was actually rushing because I had to get everything ready for the Christmas dinner. And for some reason, I kind of thought, you know what, let's go ahead and check the mail just to see if anything came. So I go through it, and then I see the official seal of immigration. And then I was like, okay, maybe I shouldn't open it. I should just leave it. But I opened it and started reading it. And I was quite actually shocked to receive that it was a deportation notice. Ultimately also shocked to see that the date was just a few months over, which was, it said I had to report tomorrow, which is Valentine's Day, February the 14th. And, at the moment I was just, in a state of, shock still. I didn't know how to react. I was kind of this feeling of sadness, frustration. And then I kind of stopped, in my mind, I told myself, stop. If this is going to happen, you're not going to let this affect you this Christmas Eve, mm-hmm. this in these holidays. It might be the last time that you're going to be with your family. Right. So stop, forget about this, enjoy your time with your family, enjoy them. And then that's what I did. I kind of put that thought way back.
You didn't
in my
even
head.
Tell them.
No, I did not tell until about January 6th.
Yeah. Well, so I want to talk. We're going to go into the details of all of this, but just to give us the schematic, you actually entered the country first without documentation at the age of 8, stayed here, got an education, wanted to go to college, couldn't afford the Carolina schools because it would be out-of-state tuition. So you went back to Mexico, tried to come back illegally, and were stopped at the border and deported right there. Then came back a second time, and this is I want to get to this point now because when you came back that second time, you were seeking asylum, and so you openly talked about your case and applied for asylum at that point, right?
Correct. I can't tell. It's definitely a little bit confusing, especially because a lot of people don't know a lot about immigration and how the procedure goes. Even myself, I did not know at the moment. The time that I did cross illegally in 2013, I didn't know any other option. Like, to be quite honest, the only option that I had ever known was when I crossed on when I was 8. At that moment in my head were a lot of things. You know, I was being persecuted for being gay. All this physical abuse happened to me. I couldn't stay there. And it got to a point that, you know, I made the decision to go. And obviously I got caught. And 2014 came, and somebody that I had shared my story with contacted me, and they told me, you know what, your case, what you've been through is actually eligible. You got a shot of seeking political asylum. And I was like, well, what's political asylum? And basically, you have to go through a procedure. Somebody from immigration makes an interview to you. And then they decide if your story is eligible to be heard by a judge. If you do, then you pass through the second stage of the political asylum. And if not, then you'll be deported right there and then.
All right. So you went through some of that process in Charlotte. So tell us what the last stage of that it was when you did appear before a judge.
So obviously that happened. 2014, I got released here into the United States. And the first hearing, it was about 6 months after. And that was just an introductory hearing with the judge. So my judge was Judge Pettinato, and he's in Charlotte. And it was just basically to introduce ourselves to each other, and he kind of exposed my situation. And then he gave me another date for 2015. I don't really remember exactly the date. And on that hearing, we had to prepare, me and my lawyer, Helen Parsonage, all this evidence, all support for my case, and present it to the judge himself. And then, so that one happened. And then on the third hearing, that's the final decision that the judge makes it, if he wants to grant me asylum or not. So on the third hearing, you have the judge, you have me and my lawyer, and then you have the government's lawyer, which is the immigration lawyer. So, of course, he usually goes to try to go against you. What was surprising to us is that at that moment, when it was time for the government's lawyer to appear, you know, to go up front and ask me questions, he actually said that he accepted the story and that he didn't have any comments to make, any further questions. So when my lawyer told me that this was actually something really good, because if the government's lawyer doesn't have anything against to say about you or your case, I know it's basically that means he is actually supporting like the story. And so to our minds, we thought, you know, we actually are going to win this. But unfortunately, the judge didn't make his decision right there. But I received a letter like 2 weeks after that he had denied my decision, my asylum to stay here. And so, you know, we did our research, and if you can research this yourself on Google, he only has like around 12%.
It's one of the lowest approval rates in the country. Yeah. So the fact that they weren't going to hear from anybody suggests that the answer had already been made. And that's why, not because they didn't have a case to make, but because we reject more cases than any place in the country.
Yeah. And that's exactly what my lawyer told me. You know, she told me, I'm really sorry about this. If your case had been in California, New York, or a different state, this would have, you know, by now, right now, I would probably have a green card. And, you know, it's unfortunate, but I guess it's also, I'm trying to use this to show people that there's, you know, there's something going on here.
Your case was rejected, so that means now it's up to immigration, and they can take a look at your case, and that's when you get the letter that says, okay, the asylum appeal is over, you've lost it, and therefore you are, in their words, deportable.
Yes, so it's a... it goes into more complex things after that. There's a different types of series of appeals that you can still do, even though the judge has denied your case. All of this is obviously legal. While all my process and my asylum is pending, I'm actually eligible to get a temporary work permit and a social security number. So that's what I currently have. Now, I guess I just want to point this out. In order for me to even be here right now with you speaking, I had to go through a series of background checks, criminal record checks, and in order for me to even get a work permit, they do all of this. So all my information, immigration knows, Exactly. It's complicated, but I don't have any papers as it is. But legally, I am present. So,
and at the moment, too, your case is there's a possibility while you go to Charlotte tomorrow to find out whether or not, and they've asked you to be ready to be deported. Congressman G.K. Butterfield, Democrat from North Carolina, has acted in your behalf. Tell us what he's done.
Yes. So I guess after we appeal to the our appeal right now is pending in the Fourth Circuit. I started going, made my case public. So I started going to different rallies, events, anything that I could get support from people to know my story. And I just pointed this out because there's something really important that is thanks to the community, to actually people calling immigration, calling Representative Butterfield. He has, you know, he listened to them. He listened to their claim. And he actually wrote an official letter to Atlanta and immigration office over there asking them to, like, halt or put on hold my deportation. And it's worked.
All right, well, we'll wait and see. And we want to get more to know you more personally, your background, your life in Mexico, and your life here in the United States. You went to Riverside High School. We'll find out more about that when our conversation with Felipe de Jesus Molina Mendoza continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, talking today with Felipe de Jesus Molina Mendoza. He is an openly gay man seeking asylum in the United States. He is expected to report for deportation tomorrow in Charlotte, but there are a number of legal actions that could stay that decision, and we'll find out more about that. But I want to find out more about you personally, Felipe. You were born in Acapulco, and so talk about your earlier life in Mexico, growing up in Mexico.
So, yes, I was born in Acapulco, Guerrero. I was just born there, so I can say I really know the state. I grew up in two states, in Puebla, which is around 2 hours away from Mexico City, and also in Veracruz, which is like in the coast of Mexico. Growing up, I got to say it was, it was a different childhood than most people. You know, obviously in Mexico, you don't have the same economic things that you have here. So I grew up with my dad when I was around 5 years old, and my mom was when she decided to come to the United States. So I didn't see my mom till I was 8 years old. There was different things going on back then. You know, there's obviously this culture of machismo or sexist. So to me, my dad actually treated me really good. But it was actually to my sisters who weren't treated so good.
Two sisters?
Yeah, I got two older sisters. So, you know, he made them, you know, wash the clothes. He made them cook and everything. And he, obviously, when he got mad, like, he will hit us and stuff. You know, there were several things happening. We didn't have money sometimes. So my sisters and I would go into, like, the streets selling gum, bubble gums or lollipops to make some money. And there was this issue that at the time we didn't know because my dad, you know, hit us, and there were some actually sexual things, abuse, and within us three. Me, for my part, it was a nanny that we had, and she actually, abused me. So my mom didn't know all this because she was in the United States. So when she found out, there was a legal battle over our custody. And then my mom won that custody, but my dad actually, I guess he didn't accept that, so he took us away. He kind of kidnapped us.
Yeah.
And he took us away to Veracruz. Obviously, my mom didn't know where to find us, so that was around the age of five. So I stayed there with my dad till I was about eight. Eventually, my mom was able to find us, and so one day, well, in between that time, my dad had told us that my mom had abandoned us, and that she didn't know, she didn't care about us and anything. So we believed it. It was funny because I remember the day that she appeared. I was actually watching Pokemon. Yeah, and I remember hearing the door open, and then I looked back, and then my mom was, there was this lady, and I just kind of looked at her, and then I started kind of remember, okay, that's my mom. And everything happened really quick. She told me, she hugged me, and then she told me, get your stuff, get it back, let's go. And that's what happens with, that's what we did. My dad was working, he usually worked, he left like at 6 and came back till like 9 p.m. Mm. So it was basically us three there. So she took us back to Puebla, where she's from. And we stayed there for like a day. And then the next day, we were already in Nogales.
Right, on the border with San Diego, yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So at the moment, you know, for me, it was like a field trip. At the moment, you know, I really didn't know what was happening. I just knew that Nogales was super hot. We obviously
it's Tucson. I said San Diego, but it's on the border with Tucson, is it not? Is it the Arizona border?
Yeah, Nogales. Yeah, I think it's Tucson border, around Arizona.
Near Tucson. Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
So when she came back, I think she had made a lot of different expenses, so she didn't have a lot of money. So I remember we didn't have enough money to get on the bus to go to this small village in Nogales we had to go to in order to cross the border. So we were walking on the street, kind of going towards the destination. And I remember looking at the ground, and I actually found like 100 pesos at the time. And it was like, yeah, so everything was like, yes, everything kind of worked out. So yeah, we were able to get on the bus, and we left the small village in Nogales. That's when we saw the coyotes. They were actually, it was two kids. They were 13 and 14 years old.
Wow. You're about to entrust your lives to two strangers who are not yet 15 years old.
Yeah. So, you know, I was a kid, so I was like talking to them, and they were talking to me, and we were kind of playing around there. And then we waited till it was night. And after that, that's when my mom told us, you know, get ready, go to the bathroom and everything, you need to go. And that's when I started getting scared, because there was like a storm coming as well. And so we went out, and I just remember everything was just pitch black. And we were just running. My mom was holding my hand, and I was holding my sister's hands. And now, you know, we tripped and everything. We fell like on different things. And then it started raining. And the rain actually kind of helped, because it was so hot in Nogales, and like it was like the desert. So it was really hot. So it kind of refreshing us. And then there was a lot of lightning. So with the lightning, we kind of see exactly where we were going. Right. And then there's a really funny story about that when I was... So when I left, you know, how my mom told us to just pick up her stuff and go. So I didn't have time to change nothing. So at the moment, I had these tennis shoes that light up.
Oh, no.
Yes. Oh, and it was because so nobody knew that.
You are going to run across the border in the middle of the night with these little flashing red lights on your shoes.
Yeah. So what my mom did was just like she pulled down my pants, like it was school pants, tied them up. And so I was kind of running around like with my pants half, like to half my leg. And yeah, so that happened. And then, everything went on, and I just remember eventually we got on the plane, and then we arrived in New York City. And it was like a totally different world to me.
I want to ask you about that, but I have to say, you know, those thunderstorms down there in southern Arizona, while they may be refreshing, they're also dangerous because that caliche doesn't really absorb much. So what you've got is these arroyos fill up very fast, and it's exceptionally dangerous when those sudden downpours begin to fill dry riverbeds, and suddenly what looked like a safe passage isn't. So all that, you make it through, you get to New York now. So tell us about, you settled in the Bronx, right?
Yeah, so we arrived at the Bronx, and we had an uncle there who took us in. And, you know, I had my cousin, that's where I met my cousin, Aris. He was just wonderful to me. He shared with me his Game Boy and all this. So for me as a kid, you know, everything was new. Everything was just so exciting to see, you know, people in Mexico. All I saw, you know, it's Mexican people. So when I came here and I saw these different colors of people, it was just shocking. It was like a cultural shock to me. But I took it, and it took me some time. I got to say, I did struggle a little bit in school, especially.
I remember, you're 8 now.
Okay. Yeah.
Keep going.
So, you know, thankfully in New York, they have bilingual schools. So I got to say, I really didn't learn a lot of English there, mm-hmm. because most of my classmates were Puerto Rican or Dominican, so I mostly speak Spanish. Eventually I passed the ESL, and I lived there for about maybe 3 years, around when I was 12. And then my uncle moved to North Carolina, and he convinced my parents to move as well. So that's when I kind of said goodbye to New York. And that's when I started living here.
And when you say parents, your mother remarried, so you have a stepfather now, and your mother, and you moved with your stepfather and your mother to Yadkinville, right?
Yeah, Yadkinville, North Carolina. That's where we arrived. And at the moment, it was also hard there because my uncle, who had previously helped us, for some reason, he didn't help us when we arrived here in Yadkinville. So we were left actually kind of stranded. When we arrived in Yadkinville, we didn't have like a house, nowhere to like go to. So I remember my parents, you know, I really don't know how they got the money. I think they asked for money. So they rented an apartment that same day. And remember we had to like sleep on the floor for a few days because we really didn't have anywhere else to sleep on. And eventually, you know, they enrolled me into school because that is one thing, you know, I would never blame my parents for it. My mom has given her life to give us everything, you know, the best that she could. And that is something that I will always, always be grateful for.
And, they found work? What were they doing?
They found different types of work. My mom was a hairstylist, so she cut hair, and she eventually got her license and everything. They found, like, work in the same apartments that we rented. They talked to the person who was in charge of the apartment. So they let them like paint the apartments, clean the apartments and everything. And so we struggled for probably the first few years. And then I started going to school. And that was also a struggle because in New York, I always spoke Spanish. And then Yadkinville here, the schools, there were no Spanish. Mm-hmm. All of my classes were in English. And I remember this... this teacher, Mr. Sammy, taught history, and he will pull me at the end of the class, and he'll pull me aside and tell me, like, did you understand everything? And sometimes I didn't. So he will stay with me all the time that I required to help me. And, you know, it's, I guess, small things like that I remember really well.
Yeah. Well, and you could stay, and you were doing well in school?
Yes, so that was one of the things, I guess, I made a promise to myself, because growing up, since I was a kid, I always saw the struggle of my parents, especially my mom, you know, how she struggled to work, to provide food for us, and so I decided I kind of make my promise to myself that I would not be a burden to her. So since I was in school, I always try to make the best grades, always try to keep out of way from trouble. To not cause any more problems, you know.
And she felt that was important too. She wanted to keep you in school, and
yeah,
so that you could do that and not have to do what she was doing.
Yes, she always believed that school was, you know, the best thing that could happen for us. And till right now, you know, I still haven't given up in school, and. We're kind of like the first generation of from my whole family to actually have a degree. So I really do want to go to study and get my degree. And, you know, I think I owe that to my mom. And I owe that
well, it's the American story. A first generation of immigrants come here, work hard. They of course, contribute to the economy. They buy things. It circulates through. Pay taxes one way or the other. Often have a tax identification number in which taxes are taken from them. Certainly pay sales tax and property tax via their rent. So all that's happening for immigrants historically in the United States, and the second generation gets an education. You went to – your mother eventually moved to Durham, right? Your parents
yeah.
moved here. So what brought them to Durham?
So at the time, Durham was kind of in development. So seeing in Yadkinville, it was a small town. There wasn't a lot that we could do. So eventually, I think they decided because Durham was bigger. So, you know, they obviously knew about Raleigh. But Durham was, I guess, kind of cheaper at the time as well. Mm-hmm. So that's when we moved over here to Durham. And I graduated elementary in Yadkinville, and then I came here to Durham and started. And
went to Riverside.
Yes.
And you did well. You ended up with you were taking AP classes, right?
Yeah, I took AP French. I did pre-calculus. My last year, I kind of gave myself like a treat, and I took like course and art. And that was actually something I appreciate of myself doing, because I really enjoyed music, learning how to read music. It was something totally new to me. Yeah. And but yes, I always try to, you know, I was in the honor roll, and I did always try to get like at least an A, or no, I would be mad if I got like a B.
finished up with a 3.8. Am I right about that? Is that right?
Yeah.
And that's including the AP classes. So you're doing pretty well. You want to go to college, but you couldn't go here.
No. So growing up, I knew that I didn't have papers. But I actually didn't know how big of a deal that was until I got to around junior, the second semester. You know how they let you sometimes get like some juniors get like parking for school. And I remember telling my mom, you know what, I want to drive to school. Because, you know, Eric is doing it. Classmates. Yeah. And then that was like the first thing I noticed. I was like, well, you need a driver's license. And I was like, well, can I go get one? And my mom told me, like, no, you can't. Like, you don't have a social. And so I guess that was the first time that I noticed that things were different, you know, that actually made a huge impact.
It's interesting because they would have been well aware of it, certainly your mother, well aware of the vulnerability, right, that she was living in, the danger, and somehow she didn't pass that on. She had to be living with that anxiety every minute, and somehow she didn't pass that on.
I know she told us always to stay quiet about, you know, our situation. She told us that we didn't have papers, and but it was something that, I guess, you know, as a mother, you try to protect your children. Mm-hmm. And but she always told us, you know, if somebody asks, just try not to talk about it. Or so I did. And then senior year came, and, you know, started applying for college and getting all this. You know, obviously, I got like offers from scholarships and colleges as well. So I went to my counselor, and then she was like, okay, I'll help you fill it out and everything. So when we got to the part, she was like, what's your social security number? And I was like, well, I don't have one. And that's when she told me, she's like, well, like, all of these scholarships, and, you know, it's great that you're getting them, but you can't apply for any of them because they all require a social. And that's, I guess, that was when it really hit me. I was like, well, like, but I want to go to college. And, you know, I want to do what my other classmates are doing, you know, go to college, get a degree and everything. And, so from then on, I guess I was really brought to reality.
Yeah. Well, and then you realized you couldn't really afford full freight if you had to pay. You were probably eligible for some of these scholarships. They were pretty sure that you would have gotten something, but you're not going to be able to apply. So then you decide you still want to go to school, and you decide to go back to Mexico for that, right?
Yeah, so that was actually, at the moment, I didn't know what to do. I was obviously kind of like in a depressed state because, you know, my classmate kept asking me, no, have you applied to this? Have you applied to that? And like, well, the only thing I could tell them is like, I'm working on it. But eventually the moment came when my mom talked to me because she obviously noticed this. And she told me, you know what, you got two choices. You can either stay here and hopefully we'll pray that something will happen, and that you'll be able to, you know, adjust your status somehow and, you know, go to college. And meanwhile, you can just work at, like, McDonald's or something. Or I make you this offer to go back to Mexico, and I'll pay for your college. If you can go to college there and finish your degree, and maybe later on you can come back with a work visa. You know, I was 17 and a half that time. And, I wanted to study, and I guess that's why I did it. I went back to Mexico, and it was hard. I remember I was crying, and so I took a bus It was almost up around 4 days, you know, traveling across the United States to Mexico. And there were several times where I cried and I wanted to get off the bus, call my mom and go back. And, but I kind of, you know, kind of shut myself up and told myself, stop, you know, this is the only way that you can progress and have a life. And so I kind of sucked it up and
went to Mexico.
Yes.
For school. Well, we will pick up the story from there after these messages. I am talking with Felipe de Jesus Molina Mendoza, born in Mexico, asking for asylum in the U.S. He may be deported tomorrow. And just ahead, we'll find out what happened in Mexico, how he returned, and about his status at the moment. On the State of Things, please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Felipe de Jesus Molina Mendoza, born in Mexico, asking for asylum in the United States. He is living as an openly gay man, and that puts him in danger and physical violence in Mexico. That is the basis of his asylum claim here in the United States. He may be deported tomorrow. And we talked, Felipe, before the break, you were talking about the decision to go back to Mexico to get a college degree. So you go back. Tell us what happened next.
So I arrived in Mexico. I arrived in Puebla, the last place I was there before I left to the United States. So I arrived there, and, you know, it was just shocking to see the difference, big difference between the United States and Mexico. And, you know, I probably cried like the first 3 days, to be honest. You know, I really didn't have like anybody there. I knew I had like distant family, but that was it. So I stayed there for a few months, and I remember, you know, it was just too different. I needed something bigger, and so I've moved to Mexico City. And that's where I actually started college, in Mexico City. And it was also kind of hard because in Mexico City, I didn't have nobody at all. So I literally just went one day, and on that same day, I had to get like an apartment and everything, so that happened, and I started, because I enjoy music so much, and in chorus in senior year, I actually wanted to become like an audio engineer at the time, and so I started college studying that, and then I was finishing up the semester, and this was around 2009 and the start of 2010, finishing up the semester, and then my grandmother, who was in Mexico, she was really ill. And I remember we received a call saying that she literally had just a few days left. And it was hard, you know, because it was my grandmother, but it was hard because it was my mom's mother. Mm. And she called me and she told me, you know, this is happening and I wanted to speak with you because, you know, she's my mom. She hadn't seen her mom for like almost 10 years. And I told her, you don't really need to think about this. You know, go. Well, come here and be with your mom. And so she did. She sold everything that she had here in North Carolina, and she went back to Mexico. And my grandmother passed away. And but at least my mom was able to be with her till her last breath. And you know, after that, my mom was pretty devastated. I guess in my case, that meant I didn't have any more economical support.
I mean, the point is she is paying your way through college, and she's having this conversation with you because it's going to mean now she won't have the money to continue to support your college education if she comes back and has this conversation with you. You say, Mom, come back. See your mother. She does. But now you got to figure out a way, and you have a job, and you're in Mexico City.
Yeah, so I'm in Mexico City. I know, you know, I'm less than a month away of having to pay rent. Obviously, I had to drop out of college. So I started, you know, before this, I had never actually gotten like a real job. I know I had worked in here in Durham before, Captain D's, but it was like, you know, cashier and stuff. So I was able to get a job in a call center. You know, customer service for here in the United States. So so I had to get a job, and I started working. And obviously, with all the expenses and no support from here in the United States, I had to literally be working from then on. And then at the end of 2010, kind of the midst towards the end, and that's when I kind of decided to become openly gay. And a lot of people ask me why. Well, why then? Mm. And I guess taking it from everything that had happened to me, you know, that basically, you know, my life was kind of taken away because I didn't have papers, and that was something that I knew I had, that it was me, you know, and I wanted to be true to myself. I was like, well, maybe, you know, all these things I can't choose, you know, a lot of people are choosing for me, or systems, immigration systems, and being gay, that's something that is me, and I you know, I don't want to hide it anymore. That's the only thing I can hold on to that I know is true to myself. And so I think that's the main reason I did it.
How long had you been hiding it?
Oh, well, I kind of knew already since I was 13.
Yeah.
I wasn't really, didn't pay any attention before that. But so I knew in high school, I definitely knew that I was gay. I was really fearful of how my family was going to react. You know, my mom have always shown me her love and everything, but obviously in Mexican culture, they're more reserved into this matters. And my stepdad at the time, whenever he saw a topic about gay topic, LGBTQ, he would make these remarks, you know, not favorable remarks. So that kind of obviously gave me the idea not to say it. And then in Mexico, I was there, and that's when I decided to come out.
Well, I was going to say that. So on the one hand, you realize that this is your essential self. This is who you are. This is how you were born into the world. And to be honest to yourself and faithful to who you are, you made that choice. On the other hand, you are making that choice in Mexico, where at least by reputation and by your own account here, is far more difficult for a gay man. Was it for you?
Yeah, well, at the moment, you know, I was 18. I really didn't know exactly what that meant. All I knew is, you know, I had me, and I wanted to be free, and that's what I did. And then, you know, everything kind of went, like the first few months, there was no problem with that. And I guess there was a phase of me, you know, where I went and started wearing more colorful clothes, and, you know, in Mexico City, there's what they call the pink zone, or zona rosa, and it's really supposed to be gay-friendly. So I visited there a lot, and that's when I started noticing this different things happening. First, it was just the remarks that people sometimes made when I walked across the street. They will really, call out names to me. I really don't want to see those names here.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, you know what? I can handle this. I'll just ignore it and keep on moving with my life. So that's how it was. But as I went through with this, I started noticing that it became more and more frequent. This remark started, appearing, or people calling these names to me. And then, it got to the point where it actually kind of escalated to become more, instead of just verbal abuse, and they started like pushing me. Like people would walk like straight to me and like pushed me. And, you know, they usually did this in like groups. And especially the men, that's where I really got most of the abuse and the verbal things.
Did it ever get more violent than that?
Yes. So eventually they started getting more, physical things. And then it got to a point where I got chased by like a group of 8 men. First they started calling me names. That was actually, I was with my boyfriend at the time. We were holding hands. And so they started calling us names. We ignored them and we kept walking. I guess they kind of got mad because of that. And they started following us. We noticed this and started walking faster. We even crossed the road to try to kind of lose them. When they noticed that, they started actually running and chasing us. And we panicked. We just straight out ran wherever we could. And they started, you know, calling us names. And they told us that if they grabbed us, they were going to beat us up. And they were going to rape us because that's what we wanted. And we were freaked out. We ran really fast. We were able to get to the metro station, and you know, we were panicked. We saw this police officers. There's always police officers in the metro stations in Mexico. And we told them, we need help. This is happening to us. And, at first they were kind of worried and they were listening. And then when we told them, they were calling us names because we're gay. Poof, that's where everything changed. Mm-hmm. And their expression changed. And they actually told us, we can't help you. If this is happening, this to you is because you're acting that way. You shouldn't act this way. And if you don't want things to happen, then don't be. Literally, just don't be gay. And we told them, can you open a report, do something? And they said that they didn't have evidence, that they didn't knew the guys, that they didn't see nothing, so they can't open a report. And so that was like the first time, I guess, I got denied protection from the police. And so I guess to me that was one of the main turning points, because I noticed that this was not just name calling. This was actually getting dangerous.
were there bottles involved? I understand too that there were projectiles
were different incidents. But
the main thing is that these incidents continued, that there was violence, and that it was pretty clear you were not going to get police protection.
We actually, another incident that we had is we kissed in public, and this was actually by the police themselves. When we kissed, we noticed that this. The cop car pulls up to us and turns the lights on. And then they started asking us questions. They were like, what are you doing? And they're like, nothing. We're just talking. And we kiss. And apparently they got mad because of that. And they told us, well, you're not supposed to be doing this. This is not, it's not decent for you to do it in public. And they told us that it wasn't even allowed in public. And, they actually told us to get up and to put our hands behind our head, and they started searching us, and they started like really forcing, like searching us, and they want us to actually arrest us because of that. But there were more people around there, and the funny thing is that to the other couples, nothing happened to them. Like, it was only to us. So they told us that if they catch us again doing something or holding hands, they would definitely arrest us and take us in. And so that was one of the other incidents that was like, well, even if your government is actually against you, what protection can you expect?
So tell us about then your decision to return to the United States.
Yeah. So the last strike was when I actually got a tag. I was walking and a car pulled up and it was full of men. I don't really know if they were drunk or not. But I remember they started throwing glass bottles to me. And then eventually one of the bottles broke and they wanted to actually attack me with the bottle. The bottles definitely, they threw them with force. They left me bruised, like around my neck and everything. And seek help. I got denied the help. And at that point, I was already so depressed with all the frequent attacks and all these assaults coming to me that there was a point that I didn't even want to get out of my house anymore. Mm-hmm. I really didn't really, I woke up and I knew exactly what was going to happen to me that day, that I didn't want to get out. And that's when I decided, I can't be here. This is not a life for me. I don't want to become a statistic anymore, because around that time there were a lot of killings going on, even in the pink zone that is supposed to be gay friendly, lots of killings of gay people, of transgender people. And I decided,
despite the fact that gay marriage is legal in Mexico, because it is now. And so what about that? Have things changed? One of the reasons you were denied is asylum. You came back to the U.S. seeking asylum for those reasons, and they've said since then, gay marriage has been legalized. It's not as dangerous as it used to be in Mexico for you.
One thing we got to understand that, and I think people don't know, is that media in Mexico is controlled. It's not here. It's not like here. The Mexico passed the same-sex marriage law, but it actually has not been enforced. There's still a lot of killing, and I can tell you this because my lawyer had looked into this. People are still dying in Mexico City because they're gay and because they're discriminated, persecuted. And there was recently a march that is called La Marcha de la Familia, or the March for the Family. And it was huge, like huge in masses in Mexico. And they were actually literally going against gay marriage. And so this is just for you to show you how much, you know, they don't like gay people.
And yet in this country now, just last week, we saw reports of Immigration and Customs Enforcement raids in six states in this country, including North Carolina. And I wonder if you're concerned about your family and others in your community.
You know, it's yes. Well, definitely, we are definitely concerned, but this isn't something new. This has been happening for years, even in the Obama administration happened as well. While we are concerned, and I guess the biggest threat right now is the executive orders that President Trump has made. This is actually really bad for us. Why? Because those executive orders are really vague. That means immigration can interpret them how they want. And if they can do that, they literally have nobody to stop them.
I want to talk a little bit. I've only got about a minute left, but I want to know, just name the organizations, because there's certainly a group that has helped you, but also the NAACP now has joined the case. This is unusual for the NAACP.
Yes, so the first group that started helping me directly was Alerta Migratoria, and they're actually here in Durham, and they actually helped also with the case of Wilden Acosta. And then a few weeks later, I met the NAACP, Anna Blackburn, and in a vigil, and I also met Reverend Barber. So he publicly said that he will support me, and since that day, they really have supported me in my case.
So this suggests that there's a broader coalition around fairness and decency in your case and in others. And again, now I've got about 30 seconds left, but what's your sense of that and what the support has been in this growing coalition?
I can only say that, you know, in this negative times right now, I can still see hope, especially because a lot of people, different races, is they have been helping me, supporting my case. And now you have this something new that is happening, that different organizations are kind of joining together to fight this. And it's something really amazing.
Good luck to you, Felipe, and a pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much for spending your time with us.
No, thank you so much for having me here and to let me share my story.
Felipe de Jesus Molina Mendoza, born in Mexico, seeking asylum in the U.S. You can find out more information at our website, stateofthings.org, a program produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Charlie Sheldon Orman, Laura Pelliser. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, WNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.